Have you ever wondered how preeclampsia is handled by midwives or how you can prevent it from occurring in the first place? Today on the podcast, I interview Tiffany Alblinger, a home birth midwife with Beautiful One Midwifery in San Diego, and we talk all about preeclampsia through a midwifery model of care lens. We discuss the basic things like what it is, what the symptoms are, and how you might come to be diagnosed. But then we talk about prevention from a holistic point of view and what can be done if you've had preeclampsia in a previous pregnancy and you don't want to get it again. Tiffany also explains how she uses a functional medicine approach to looking at a woman's whole diet and lifestyle to work at optimizing birth outcomes from before they even become pregnant, and then what she does to support them if the body is starting to show the signs of tracking towards preeclampsia. It's a fascinating conversation, so let's dive in.
Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes.
Growing a baby, healing postpartum, making milk, your body's mineral needs are off the chart during these times. And that's why Dr. Leah and I swear by Relight by Redmond, the real salt people, an electrolyte powder packed with USA mined unrefined sea salt and essential minerals like magnesium, calcium, and potassium. Unlike many popular electrolyte companies, Redmond is the only company who is completely transparent about their sodium source because they own and operate the mine. It's clean, delicious, and the perfect thing for labor, breastfeeding, and thriving in mom life. So go ahead and grab a sample pack to try all of the flavors or hand your trust over to me and start with strawberry lemonade. Go to redmond.life and use code HEALTHYMOTHER for 15% off. Hydration handled. Okay, so with us today is Tiffany from Beautiful One Midwifery. Your partner in crime is Kelly. She's not here with us today, but I'm so happy that you're here. We're going to be talking all about preeclampsia. And it's a topic that I get asked about all of the time because there's, you know, controversy and it's kind of a gray area. Sometimes it really can affect birth. Sometimes people feel like they didn't really have it necessarily when they were told they did. And then some people want to know how to prevent getting it from the future in the future again. So there's a lot of different things we're going to cover today. But before we do, I just want you to give us an introduction about who you are and your midwifery practice, and so that we can kind of get a baseline from you and then we'll get going.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here, especially talking about this topic, because I think women think it's just something that happens to them and they don't have a whole lot of control over how to navigate it. And so hopefully what we get to share and discuss here today is going to provide some pieces of empowerment and autonomy and taking control of your health. And that's what we are all about in our home birth practice. We practice in San Diego. I think that's how we know you, Morgan, is because you started out, you know, your motherhood journey and just your career here. And I think that's how we ended up getting connected. But we follow each other on Instagram and we have so many of the same sentiments and philosophies. And so I know there's a lot of overlap on looking at the root cause and challenging societal expectations and, you know, bucking against the system a little bit and just empowering women with education. And so that's what we do with our own client base here in San Diego. Obviously, having a home birth, you know, you're a part of that demographic. It's a special kind of lady. You know, you definitely arrive to a specific place of taking control and wanting to have some of those pieces as a part of your motherhood journey. And so we have found ways to allow that sentiment to be experienced in lots of spaces and especially online. So that's what we do. We have an in-person practice and then we have lots of online education and support all centered around giving women alternatives in their childbearing years.
Yeah, perfect. I mean, I think that's exactly who our audience is. They're on the less conventional side or they're maybe exploring how to have more sort of a say and understanding that it's not necessarily exactly as we've been told and
not that there's like a nefarious agenda behind that necessarily, but it's just kind of like it worked for the system for a reason and with like the money machine that all the medical society is. And so how do we learn about our physiology, actually get true informed consent, and then make the choices there? So with preeclampsia, there is some of that because some people are just put on baby aspirin the second that they get pregnant because of their age for prevention of preeclampsia. Or some people manage it with a high protein diet called the Brewer diet, or some people never get it at all, you know, whatever it is. So I would love for you to give us an overview of what exactly is going on when a patient is developing preeclampsia, and what are some of the symptoms that they can be looking out for to see that it's happening potentially to them.
Yeah. So, excuse me. We, our approach to just taking care of women in all of pregnancy is from this like idea of what is your body trying to do physiologically when it's healthy and set up for a low risk, healthy experience of pregnancy and birth. And that's the foundation. That's what we're looking at. What does a healthy body do really well on its own or with really, you know, foundational support? And when something goes outside of that box, how do we bring it back into normal? How can we use tools that we need to bring back into normal? So in some ways, preeclampsia is, obviously it is. It is a true disease process with really serious implications and complications for both mom and baby. And so we need to take that seriously. But we also need to look at some of the opportunity that we have in providing stability and foundations of health even before pregnancy starts. And so this is such a great conversation that doesn't, the information that we share and the ideas here, it doesn't have to be just about preeclampsia. It can be about so much more. And so I think sometimes women want this really targeted approach. And then when it comes back down to lifestyle and nutrition and understanding, you know, how your body functions, there's almost this bit of like this letdown of like, oh, that's it. I just have to work hard and be healthy and do the work of being a healthy individual. So I'm just prefacing it with that because I think there'll be a lot of well, let's look at the body system and what how it needs to be supported while we address some of these factors. But preeclampsia is, you know, as a disease process is typically manifested at the end of pregnancy, or we start to see the sign, we start to see the scary signs and symptoms at the end of pregnancy, but it's actually something that it's the end of a story that is potentially being told the entire pregnancy, if you know how to look for it, or even before pregnancy begins, which I mean, I 100% believe that preeclampsia is already at play potentially before even conception. So we have an opportunity there to not find ourselves where most women do. I mean, we're looking at a statistic that's 5 to 10% of women are going to be diagnosed with preeclampsia. And in my practice as a home birth midwife, I'm only working with low-risk women in a pretty low-risk population. But there's still the potential for it to for this disease process to develop. However, when we look at statistics, you know, nationally, we have to put that in perspective, 5 to 8% of the total population. And so in a low risk population, that statistic is much lower over the course of a practice in the past 5 years. We've had maybe one case of preeclampsia. And I think it ended up bordering more on HELLP syndrome, which we can talk about today too. But that disease process at the very end of, oh, now we have to absolutely do something about this and intervene, is usually a compromise of organ systems like kidney and liver, and the stress of pregnancy and growing a human inside of your body paired with however you came into your pregnancy or whatever, maybe developing over pregnancy, has put this stress and inflammation mostly on the circulatory system. It's a blood flow, an arterial issue usually. And the end game of that, the symptomology where the medical professional is going to jump in looks like headaches, visual disturbances, upper right quadrant gastric pain, right where your liver is. You have this persistent pain there under your rib. It looks like dizziness or just kind of like a sense of being unwell. And so those are the things that we're used to asking women at every single prenatal. We screen for this after 20 weeks. Do you have any persistent headaches? Do you have any visual disturbances or dizziness? Are you having any unusual pain? And that's how we're used to screening women, just symptomology. But once she starts to say, oh, actually, yes, there's not very much that we can do to reverse preeclampsia at that point. Once you start to have some of these issues in pregnancy, it's usually towards the end of pregnancy, even as home birth midwives who have the perspective of, you know, trying to address things as holistically as possible to bring things back into normal. Now we're potentially at weeks, months, years of this disease process manifesting. And the safest thing is for you to go have a medical induction. And so whether you have a midwife or a physician, that is going to be the next step. A medical induction is going to be recommended because that's the fastest treatment, is to, you know, get some of these symptoms under control. The fear is that because of this restricted blood flow issue, it starts to impact the baby and their ability to oxygenate and get nutrients and detoxification through the exchange through the placenta, but it also affects the mother and her own blood constriction, and that can lead to things like seizures and permanent brain damage and all of those things. So when we let it go, it is only disastrous. Preeclampsia does not resolve itself. It's not one of those things that like might turn out okay for everybody in the end. It almost always needs medical intervention by the time it's diagnosed. But there's a couple of confusing pieces in diagnosing it, like you said, Morgan, because of the severity of it, because the result of untreated preeclampsia is potentially life-threatening for the baby and the mom, there tends to be this really extreme perspective on it in treatment and in diagnosis. And so a lot of women end up hearing absolutely nothing about it until their blood pressure starts to creep up a little bit. And then the doctor's like, well, if this is preeclampsia, we need to catch it and we need to induce. And then it just sets you on this whole entire trajectory that a lot of women go out, you know, come out to the other side and they're like, I don't even know if that was necessary. Did I have preeclampsia? It was so vague. It was so all over the place. I felt controlled. I felt pushed. I felt like it was an excuse to induce me. And so I think that's a lot of women's experiences inside of the preeclampsia story.
Yeah. So thank you for all of that. It's amazing. What is the medical diagnostic criteria that is going to then push you as a midwife or an OBGYN in a hospital to say, yeah, this is happening? Or like, what are the, because I know there's like part of something on a UA, you know, with the urine analysis, with the blood pressure. So how do you guys look at that? And what is the kind of cutoff that they'd be seeing?
Yeah. So sorry about my whole phone situation here.
That's okay. It's allergy season.
I thought I got it. I worked really hard on getting it all up before we recorded. So diagnosis for preeclampsia, there's two factors for clinical diagnosis. And the first one is a new onset of hypertension or high blood pressure. And that threshold is 140 over 90. That's the blood pressure reading that you get. And it needs to be recorded on two separate occasions that are 4 hours apart. And so a lot of times women, they have this blood pressure that's sort of creeping up, which is actually physiologically normal for our blood pressure to increase with blood volume and the end of pregnancy. And so understanding your baseline, understanding your interaction with potential white coat syndrome, taking your own blood pressure at home, those are all things that women can do to have a little bit more autonomy over these pieces. But a lot of women will have this creeping up of blood pressure. Then they'll go and get one bad reading at their care provider's office, and then automatically they're like, well, you're a candidate for induction now. We can't have these high blood pressure readings. So it's important that women understand that your physician in the United States needs to have two blood pressure readings that are above 140 over 90, and they need to be at least 4 hours apart. So we usually tell women, if you get a high reading like that, go home, lay down, eat something, drink something, do some mindfulness and meditation, calm yourself down and take your blood pressure at home 4 hours after you were at your doctor's office or your midwife's office, and then call them back and say, here's my blood pressure reading again, because we don't want to ignore a problem that's actually an issue and manifesting. And we also don't want to overreact, right? I mean, I'm someone who gets white coat syndrome, even if I take my own blood pressure. I mean, maybe that's because I'm a clinician.
That's so funny. There's like no way for you to get around that, only if you're sleeping.
Totally. Yes. So I just know that's a problem for me. So I need to not have my blood pressure taken at the beginning of my appointment. I just rushed in from just trying to get to the appointment. I need to not have it taken by the person who stresses me out every single time. And, you know, like there's some pieces of there where we can be really biologically reactive to some of those things and have that reflected in blood pressure.
And so if somebody is actually having a true preeclampsia manifestation, going home, eating, drinking, laying down, de-stressing is not going to change the blood pressure. It will not. It's happening. You're on a trajectory. So you don't need to worry about that, correct?
Right. Yep. Yep. You're not going to fake your preeclampsia out. you're not going to deep breathe your preeclampsia away. And then your body's like, oh, we're just going to pretend we don't have preeclampsia because she's taking deep breaths. Yes. And one other factor of that is you can get away with the two blood pressure reading criteria if you have one blood pressure reading that is 160 over 110. So nobody should have a blood pressure that is that high at any point in their pregnancy. That is something that's really concerning, and we need to check that out, because the reason that preeclampsia is so dangerous is because those high blood pressures constrict blood flow and circulation. So even if it's not preeclampsia and it's just hypertension, that's still a huge concern for us. We still need to be figuring that out. But the diagnosis criteria for preeclampsia, it's that hypertension piece, it's a high blood pressure, but it's also capturing protein in the urine. And the most accurate way to do that is to collect your urine for 24 hours. And I know that sounds disgusting. It's a gross idea. You're going to get a giant jug from the lab. It is literally like a gallon or something. And then you need to go pee in it for 24 hours. You need your urine to be collected, because we need to look at a whole 24 hours. So you can have protein in your urine and it not be a concern. You can have protein in your urine, you know, at some point throughout the day. It's a threshold. We need to see it over 24 hours is the most accurate thing. So that's the gold standard. If you are interacting with your physician who's like, you're a preeclampsia risk, here's what we're looking at, women can say, well, I understand this is the gold standard criteria. And the physician might say, well, we don't have 24 hours. And it's like, about that a little bit. What's the risk of going 24 hours and waiting for this really important urine test to be performed? I'm not having any symptoms of preeclampsia. I don't have any risk factors of preeclampsia. I've had a completely normal low-risk pregnancy up until this point. So women can start to play around with some of those pieces as they're interacting with the recommendation. And there are other ways of diagnosing protein in the urine, even with just the sample that is sometimes taken at prenatals. You know, you pee in your little cup and they dip the stick and they see urine on, or they see protein on the urine dip. And that, with a high blood pressure reading, they might be really quick to want to diagnose preeclampsia and send you in.
Yeah. And I think that that is the problem where I'm kind of obsessed with this idea. And that I, in talking with Lily Nichols on our gestational diabetes episodes, it's like, you can have, as you just said, more protein in your urine for one particular bout of peeing in that day than maybe normal. And it can just sort of happen. You also may have walked in and rushed in and feel very stressed, or you have white coat syndrome, which, in case anybody doesn't know what that means, white coat syndrome is where you have actually truly a normal blood pressure in your day to day. But when you go into a medical office and there's this kind of like a little bit of pressure, like you're talking to the cops, like maybe you feel a little nervous. And it's normal when we feel anxiety and nervousness, our central nervous or our sympathetic nervous system kicks in and it inherently increases our blood pressure so that we could like run away from the lion. But when you're sitting there in an office, you may have a falsely elevated for an acute period of time blood pressure reading. And so that's called white coat syndrome, because then potentially you go home, you get one of those little at-home machines, you're calm and chill, you take your blood pressure, it's vastly different from whatever was taken in the office. And so knowing this about ourselves is important. And it is difficult to communicate this kind of stuff sometimes to certain doctors or care providers, because they are just sort of taking your word for it. And I can understand that, but it is a real thing that they also recognize. It's just like a little bit tricky. But so also though, with what you're saying, it's like you could potentially have a situation where you have a rando high blood pressure reading and more protein in the urine than normal, but that's not. And then now all of a sudden, boom. So this is that gray area nuance where the most accurate way to look at this, if we have, unless it's very high, as you said, the 160 over 110, but if it's 145 over 92 or something, and you want to just say, okay, what's happening here? To get the 24-hour urine protein and the 4-hour apart blood pressure reading would be the most accurate picture of, is this truly happening? And if it's truly happening, we take the next steps. And nobody's like stoked about getting a preeclampsia diagnosis, but it's like, oh, thank goodness we did this though. And we figured this out and we can make next steps. Sometimes the induction is not going to be till like 36 or 7 weeks. You know, sometimes it's not right away. It's not like the next day. But they might say, we're going to keep this baby in as long as we can, but that's only like 2 more weeks or something like that. And they watch you meticulously in that time period, as they should, because I want you to explain what HELP syndrome is, because this is something I feel like no one hears about unless you're in the perinatal health space in some kind of form. So what is HELP syndrome and how is it different from preeclampsia, or how is it like, you know, the deep sequelae of preeclampsia?
Yeah. So they're both disorders that tend to stem from issues with kidney and liver function and end up impacting the circulatory availability to baby and mom. So they do tend to have similar, epidemiology, and they do have similar treatment too. But HELP syndrome is an acronym, H-E-L-L-P, and it stands for hemolysis, which is red blood cell destruction. It's something that your body does when the detox system is under a lot of stress, and elevated liver enzymes. That's something that is detectable on a blood test also when your liver is, again, under a lot of stress, lots of inflammation there, potential organ damage. That's a flag for that. And then low platelets is the last LP. Low platelets is diagnosed as less than 100,000, I don't know, something per deciliters or whatever, but the number to know there is 100. So that presentation altogether can be really similar. There can be a lot of pieces of that overlap. A lot of symptomology can be similar. We're not looking necessarily at the same pieces like high blood pressure or proteinuria, protein in the urine. But it is essentially the same type of issue. And HELP syndrome tends to manifest similarly like preeclampsia, really quickly and really severely, and sometimes without notice. Sometimes there's not a hypertensive piece of that.
And what about swelling in this as a symptom as part of that? Because I think sometimes women, experience swelling in a totally normal low risk pregnancy, but there also can be a swelling which is outside of the realm of normal. Can you kind of delineate what would be more concerning for the swelling that might be part of this picture?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I didn't address that earlier in preeclampsia, but sudden swelling of the hands and face is a symptom of preeclampsia. And I think women have general edema in pregnancy that can be really normal, or normal for them, or normal for whatever it is that they're working through in their pregnancy. You don't have to have lots of swelling in pregnancy, but it can be normal. So women sometimes get concerned with having some of that in their pregnancy and thinking, oh my gosh, am I developing preeclampsia? The type of swelling in your hands and face that happen with preeclampsia almost disfigures you. It's so alarming. So I think that's important for women to understand that, like, the swelling that's in your feet at the end of the day when you're in your last month of pregnancy is very different than the type of swelling that comes with preeclampsia.
Okay, great. Thank you for mentioning that. Now, what if somebody goes into their, we are going to talk about prevention and kind of like midwifery-based treatment models too, but what about somebody who goes into their pregnancy already having had hypertension? That's part of their life. That's part of their health picture right now. How is this managed? Or I know that you said it was like a new onset, but I guess as a clinician, how do you track that person to ensure that there also isn't some sort of like maybe masked preeclampsia, or is it just going to go much higher than the baseline?
Yeah. So a risk factor for preeclampsia is a history of hypertension. I think that's important. There's some aspect of your body trying to manage arterial health and circulation that is going to put you at risk. And we don't really understand exactly the reason that preeclampsia develops. So we don't, and there's lots of theories about what causes it. And so I think that the way that it presents and the way that it comes through in a pregnancy is going to be different for every woman, because maybe one day we will discover that it is one single cause, but the theories about what causes preeclampsia now, they all kind of fit into their own little puzzle. So depending on the health that you have when you come into pregnancy, your own specific genes, your lifestyle. I think we really undervalue lifestyle from a perspective of the things that we do have control over. It tends to have one of the biggest impacts in your health. And so when we do talk about midwifery treatment and prevention, I think that that's a huge piece of it. I forgot what the first part of your question was. I went on my own tangent.
We were talking about, if you go into your pregnancy already with hypertension, and then you were kind of talking about risk factors, and I would love for you to continue on that thread too about what are all of the risk factors for preeclampsia.
Yeah, preeclampsia risk factors include just being a first-time mom tends to put you at predisposition for preeclampsia, having hypertension. Clinically, there's also carrying multiples, history of hypertension, diabetes, kidney issues, autoimmune diseases, IVF treatment is a risk factor.
Interesting. I wonder why.
Yeah, IVF is a risk factor for almost everything. And so I think that it tends to be just kind of placed. I'd love to do more research on this in the future, but it just tends to be kind of placed in the there's some connection here that's not allowing for this really biological, physiological process, and we haven't put our finger on it. And so I think that tends to be a part of it. Higher BMI and advanced maternal age. I mean, that we love to put those ladies in high risk categories all the time. So all of that to say, an individual approach, looking at individual risk factors, understanding general health, I think is really important part of looking at your own personal predisposition to preeclampsia. The things that are really big red flags for me as a midwife is any type of anything that makes me think that organ systems are compromised in some way. So issues with blood sugar, stability, severe hormone imbalance, issues with just like toxicity in general. I think that the liver is a really important piece to pay attention to in pregnancy. It's really taxed in pregnancy. It's really taxed in just modern life. And so paying attention to that and getting the liver as healthy as possible, I think is a really important piece. So anytime that I see some of those factors, women who have high incidence of miscarriage is a risk factor for me as a clinician, because I'm looking at potential genetic things at play, like MTHFR is linked up with preeclampsia risk factors. So there's lots of intercrossing that I think taking a really thorough history and really understanding the woman and where she's coming from and her general lifestyle and her family history and all of that, especially when we get the opportunity to do preconception counseling or really early prenatal appointments, which are just not common in our medical setup, right? Women who take advantage of those things and providers who provide them have a really beautiful opportunity to catch some of these risk factors and mitigate them and create a plan for them. So women who come into pregnancy with a history of hypertension, I'm automatically going to say, okay, listen, this is probably going to come up in your pregnancy at some point. You've struggled with it in the past. Pregnancy is a taxing time. Your mission in this pregnancy is to take care of your blood pressure. And this is how we're going to do it. We're going to create this whole plan for you. We're going to check in on some of these factors. We're going to be monitoring your blood pressure more often than usual. We're going to put you on this herbal prophylaxis. We're going, right? So there's a plan there with a care provider who really understands how some of these pieces can come together and try to prevent the disease process from continuing.
And now a word from our sponsor. As we're talking about birth and postpartum support, I want to share my favorite reproductive health nutrition brand, Needed. Pregnancy and postpartum are the most nutritionally demanding phases of a woman's life. Many women will stop their prenatal after birth, but we actually recommend continuing it for at least the first 9 months postpartum and longer if you're breastfeeding. Needed's prenatal multivitamin is the most robust formula I've ever seen, and it contains the bioavailable nutrients you need in evidence-based dosages, which are well above the bare minimums that most prenatals settle for. Their quality standards are also top tier, with transparent sourcing and rigorous third-party testing. And that is why now over 6,000 practitioners recommend Needed. Now also, we have the results from their IRB-approved clinical study, which confirms what we see clinically, that women who take the Needed prenatal multi had significantly higher blood levels of nutrients critical for postpartum and beyond, including vitamin D, B6, B12, riboflavin, K2, and selenium. Only women in the Needed group reached the sufficient levels of vitamin D, which plays a big role in immune health, energy, and mood regulation, all so important during the postpartum season. So while there are many ways to support yourself postpartum, continuing your prenatal is one of the simplest, most impactful ways to do it, and Needed makes it easy. So learn more at thisisneeded.com/thrive to see more about the study, and use code HEALTHYMOTHER for 20% off of your first order. Yes, healthy mother, as a little mantra or affirmation for yourself. It's so cool. Okay, now back to the show.
And that's how it should be every single time. Like, can you imagine if that was how it was always, where there's a perfectly like individualized plan where it's empowering. It's not like, you know, in the back of the doctor's mind, he's just watching it creep up, but it's not over 140 over 90 yet. So we're not going to talk about it. We're not going to say anything to her. We're not going to try to do anything or halt the process or even like attempt, you know. And when I say these things and I'm kind of like laughing through it, I'm not making fun of any one particular person. It's just to highlight the systemic or the system's issues. It makes no logical sense. Even somebody with no medical training can say, like, this comes up a lot with autoimmune diseases where it's like, you know, your antibody level, let's just take Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which is like your autoimmune low thyroid. The antibody level threshold is what, like 19 or something like that, where that's now diagnosable. And I see it all the time where people will have antibody level of like 13 or 15. And they're like, well, I don't have Hashimoto's. So it's like, you know, whatever. It's like, well, but like something is happening. And yes, some autoimmune antibody production does happen in a healthy body, but it should be a lower threshold than that. And we should still care just because it's not all the way to the point of disease. Now we should still care and be tracking and say, what can we do to optimize? Like, what is happening? So I love the way that you said that about like, here, this is going to be your big top priority throughout this pregnancy because it has huge impacting lasting effects. It can completely change the way that your end of pregnancy and birth plans go. You know, this may include like NICU stay and different things, which nobody wants. Nobody's signing up for that. So anyway, you said that. And I have another question, which, you know, you hear a lot of the time in that preeclampsia is a problem of the placenta. And I'd love your thoughts on that. How do you think that plays in?
I think that when you look at a lot of potential outcomes, adverse outcomes, it's really easy to connect to the way that the placenta implanted in the uterus. And we see that with growth issues with baby. We see that with even like gestational diabetes. We see that with preeclampsia. And that, I think, is the piece that we're really trying to sort out as a scientific community is what is that? What is that placenta implantation process? Clearly, it is the way that the mom gets nutrients and oxygen. I mean, it is the gate. It is the gate that lets in nutrients and oxygen to the baby. The baby enjoys all of those things, goes through its own filtration system, and then it also allows waste products to go back out into the mom's system for the mom to take care of the waste. So it's a really dynamic and completely essential organ. And I think that when we hear placenta, we just go, ew, somebody ate that after they had a baby. You know? No, it's an organ. It's an organ that belongs to the baby and it's the filtration system. It is like the gate that lets the good things in and helps the bad things get out. And the implantation that happens in the very beginning of embryonic life as that embryo first attaches to the inside of the uterus and makes its first little firm home. It's an incredible thing to look up if you are interested in the, you know, human science of it. But the little vascular structures that happen instantly so that it can get connected to nutrients, that is what ends up developing. So we know so much about like genetic mutations and issues with, you know, those first stages of life and how fragile that is and all of that cell division and how that is impacting so much. I mean, Morgan, you and I were talking earlier about midline defects like tongue ties and stuff. We know that that potentially is happening right at that first cell division. And so it's a important part to understand going into pregnancy, having all of your nutrient stores up and, all systems firing in order to give that implantation process its best possible start. Most women, of course, this is happening before you even miss a period. So, there's so much we could get into with like nutrient deficiencies and the role of like dad's DNA contribution and stuff like that.
Yes. So is there anything known right now about that? Because I feel like the more and more time goes on, the sperm finally is getting its moment to be like, yo, you matter a lot. And you may really matter specifically with placental formation and the implantation and all of that side of things. But I don't know if there's much concrete evidence or if this is all theory.
Yeah. So there is some developing science, of course, that needs to be continued to be researched, but men do have contribution and there is, I mean, we see it outside of fertility that there is genetic compatibility. I mean, that's right. And so when the sperm first meets the egg, that's its very first interaction with how compatible are these two genes going to be together. There's things called sperm antigens where women have like an immune response to having sperm in their body, but especially at the point of conception that can cause issues and inflammation and stuff. And then there's the quality of DNA inside of the sperm. We know that there's all these pieces we're putting together. We know that when fragmented and damaged sperm at the time of implantation, that can cause abnormal placentation where the placenta attaches. And during that, when those first few vascular structures are being made, it kind of sets the scene. It kind of sets the foundation. And then we can see lots of complications from poor quality embryo development, the placenta function throughout the entire pregnancy. That placenta is developing along with the baby. And so that I think absolutely that DNA contribution can create a lot of dysfunction. And I think that we're starting to learn that men's lifestyle affecting the quality of their sperm. We used to not consider age as being a risk factor for sperm. We just thought that sperm was great all the time, no matter what. The men's contribution is just always good and preserved. But now we know that age can be a factor. At what point, how old the man is when he contributes the sperm. So there's many pieces about that we're still learning. And placenta implantation issues, again, like I said, it can be related to so many complications and disease processes in pregnancy, but preeclampsia is definitely getting one of those flags for it.
I love thinking too about the idea that sperm health has a huge contribution to the woman's morning sickness experience. And some of that filters through the idea of placental histamine production and how histamines might be the ones that are contributing to that woman's particular type of morning sickness. It's like very fascinating. And yeah, we really, really need to, it takes two to tango and it always has, but nobody ever talked about his part, and it needs to be an absolutely 50-50 full on intentional experience together to do this. So thank you for all of that. So now let's dive into prevention. So prevention in general, and what about the woman who's had one pregnancy already where she was diagnosed with preeclampsia? She's freaking out. She wants to get pregnant again. She doesn't know what she should do or how she can increase her chances of things not trending that way again.
Yeah. And that's most of our experience as well. So it's a funny thing about home birth, and you probably have noticed this too, is that everybody wants to go have their first baby in the hospital just to see how it goes, to see how they do, to see if they can handle it, to do a little test run. And then they have a terrible experience and then are motivated to come have their second baby at home. So we deal with a lot of we take care of a lot of moms having their second baby because of that. And moms who come to us who have had preeclampsia before are like, I'm mostly just concerned about this happening again because it almost completely destroyed everything about my experience because of developing preeclampsia. So most of our protocols and most of what we offer in our practice is based off of taking care of moms who have had preeclampsia with their first. And so far, out of a big handful of women, we have not had a reoccurrence of preeclampsia when we apply some of these things for women who have had preeclampsia before. It's huge. I mean, that can change everything for somebody. So I mentioned MTHFR testing. I think that can be an important part of the puzzle, because if you have this gene mutation, it affects the way that your body can absorb and utilize B vitamins. And that is, that creates, a buildup of homocysteine, which is inflammatory, which, can have some implications for liver and kidney damage. It all kind of fits into this puzzle, and a huge portion of the population has this inability to methylate their own B vitamins. And so understanding that and knowing that and changing the way that you supplement and support liver health, I think, is a really important factor for the pregnancy, but also just long term. It gives women a lot of information that they can use. So I think knowing that status for yourself and getting MTHFR testing is it's a great place to start for women who have had preeclampsia in the past and kind of getting a little bit more control over that. But we're paying attention to hypertension prophylaxis, teaching women just about blood pressure in general. We like to use a lot of herbs to help with blood pressure support. We're really big on diet and supplementation. There's a couple of things that are correlated to just supporting the liver and supporting vascular health that we like to recommend that women do. And then we are really watchful with lab work because, like I said, this is a story that is happening over the course of many weeks or months. And so we want to be watching, how's the liver functioning? What's happening metabolically? Are there little markers that are just slightly out of range that we can catch in the third month of pregnancy instead of the seventh or eighth month of pregnancy? Because when you start to catch those little flags and bring in some more support, bring in some extra protocols, bring in, you know, some lifestyle pieces, they can be incredibly impactful in reversing some of those pieces so that it doesn't develop into an entire disease process. And I think that's what's being really missed in other clinical care settings, is the attention to detail on those things and being willing to run a metabolic panel every single trimester and talking to the mom about, we're going to really take this value seriously. Your body is telling us that it's starting to be compromised. Let's support it now instead of letting it run full. And in a more medicalized setting with an OB or even a midwife who is just in the medical model of care, their way of taking care of somebody and helping them prepare for what might happen if they develop preeclampsia is, and I think they're truly doing this to help, but it is to start kind of soft announcing the idea of you might have an induction. And so they start talking about induction really early to try to mentally and emotionally prepare the woman. And if that is their response to, well, this is how we're going to watch this, but when it gets out of hand, we just need you to know that we're going to intervene and your birth plan's going to change, instead of let's have a whole different approach to this. Let's support your system. Let's keep an eye on it and then do something about it. Oh, this isn't my expertise. I'm not really good at the nutritional aspects of care. Let's get you hooked up with another professional. So I think women are extremely limited in a medical care model to look at this. You go into a doctor's office and say, I had preeclampsia with my last pregnancy. What are the ways that I can prevent this? And they say, well, nothing can really prevent preeclampsia, but we can put you on this aspirin regimen. And so we have tons of women who potentially actually are not even high risk for developing preeclampsia, who are being told to take aspirin every single day of their pregnancy without the risk factors to support it. And there is some research that it helps to prevent preeclampsia in some high risk populations. So I think women want more than that. I think that they understand that probably taking aspirin every single day is not the tool that's going to address the root cause of the issue. And women who have preeclampsia, we don't know exactly what causes preeclampsia, but we do know the organ structures that are involved in the imbalances there, and that women are damaging those systems when they're in a preeclamptic event, and that is probably going to contribute to some aspect of their long-term health. And there's not a consideration for that. That's not a part of the conversation. And so I think that's the concern. I think that's where women really want more information and more options.
I saw a Sarah Wickham article that was like summarizing some research that had been done. This was news to me. It's probably not to you, but it was about how aspirin was so significantly much more effective at preeclampsia prevention when given prior to, I want to say it was like 11 weeks or 17 weeks. It was very early on in the pregnancy. So I guess that would be capturing the population that is high risk that we know we're like going into it high risk or something. But then if it's given after a certain period of time, the help that it provides was so much lower. It was like nearly negligible. And I thought that was fascinating because it really just lends to the idea of this is an issue that's taking place in the very beginning of the pregnancy. We just don't have the signs and symptoms yet to tell what's happening with it, like you mentioned. And it's like, okay, well, that's the logic there. Then yes, it's taking place. And the reason why aspirin, in case people are like, why? Because of the blood thinning effect, all the vasculature effects that the aspirin would provide. And now it's my take, but I'm not that, you know, this isn't what I do day in and day out like you do. So I'd love to know your take on this. But aspirin, you know, it's not a super, there is some risks with it, of course, but it's like pretty benign overall, right? So it's like, okay, if this is what's being recommended, is it one of those things where it's just sort of overly given, but it's not really that detrimental? It's just sort of lazy, maybe, because it's not addressing the actual root cause of what's happening? Or what do you think about that? When people are like, I was recommended to take aspirin, I'm really hesitant because there's somebody who considers themselves sort of like on the natural side of things. They don't want to take a medication every single day. They're concerned about it. It does seem to work though. So, but it's probably not appropriate for everyone to be taking.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's the philosophy of it really that kind of rubs women the wrong way. I think that the care provider who recommends it is like, hey, there's pretty good research for this. It works and it decreases your risk. And I'm helping you by providing that. Isn't that cool that we have this thing that can be done in order to lower this risk? And for some women, that's going to be the answer. Oh, I can take a pill for that? Perfect. That's exactly who I am. I'm going to do that. But there's the woman who I think that her hesitation with that is, well, I don't take over the counter medication for anything. And we do have a lack of universal evidence. We do have a lack of long-term safety data. It doesn't seem like aspirin has any really big, you know, red flags or detrimental effects, but it's a blanket recommendation. It's not an individual recommendation. And if we decide that aspirin's the answer, then we're missing an opportunity to look at inflammation, to look at liver health, to look at placenta health, to, you know, I mean, like we're missing an opportunity to have a healthier pregnancy overall. And that's the cool thing about holistic treatment and holistic health is that I get to look at my client as a whole person, and my suggestions for getting metabolically healthy and stable, it's not going to just help prevent preeclampsia. It's going to make her more resilient to the myriad of other inflammatory factors and issues that can bring up all kinds of things for her. So it's missing an opportunity, I guess. Yeah, you calling it lazy is pretty accurate. I understand the woman who says, this is what I can do. I actually cannot get more invested time and resource wise. And it's really important to me that I avoid preeclampsia again. This is what I can do. That I understand that. I understand that decision. But for the woman who's like, this doesn't sit well with me, there has to be another way. We've never had anybody in our practice take the aspirin regimen after they've been given all the options. So I think women are looking for support and options, and aspirin is a cover up. It's a way of feeling like I'm doing something about it. And women who have other options and have another plan laid before them most women are going to take that. So
I think you need to make a course for all the care providers about what it is that they can do to support them so that there is other options, you know. But and on that note, you mentioned supporting liver health. And so this is one thing that, you know, I think a lot of women do know or they hear, we don't want to detox in pregnancy. We don't want to do liver detoxification things. So how are you supporting the liver while also avoiding, you know, dumping things into baby?
Yeah. So, I mean, we talk about just decreasing toxic load in general. There's a million ways to do that, as you know. that's a really big thing. Don't give your body stuff that it has to detox.
Mm-hmm. So that's like, you know, your shampoo that smells, your perfume, your then face care that has a million chemicals in it. You're getting your nail, your acrylic nails done and your eyelashes and your da da da. It's just all these little things, usually I feel like cosmetically, but also cleaning products.
Yeah, in the home. Food that you eat, yep. Right? I mean, being asleep, like being completely asleep by 11 o'clock at night, because that's when your liver cells are turning over and regenerating. Some really safe ways of supporting detox in pregnancy is like drinking lemon water first thing in the morning, having bowel movements every single day, doing dry brushing, you know, several times a week. Those are all really safe ways to support your body's detoxification process. And then we know having an adequate amount of protein supports liver health in pregnancy. I mean, it supports everything in pregnancy, but especially helps to nourish the liver and albumin production, and those types of things. So there's lots that women can do for liver health. You can take herbs. I mean, we, of course, love Nora tea. It's such an easy blend for women to get tons of health benefits from, but even just taking nettles or adding in some dandelion to your supplement regimen or herbal regimen helps to support and strengthen the liver. So there's lots of things that women can do.
Yeah. Nora tea, just in case anybody doesn't know, it's nettle, oat straw, red raspberry leaf, and alfalfa. It's like a blend. And it's kind of this beautiful thing that women can drink during your pregnancy and postpartum all the time. You could drink it anytime, really. That gives nutrients and some iron and helps with uterine tonicity, strength. You know, it's a good one. But then, okay, also you mentioned protein. And so then that made me want to ask you about the Brewer diet. So if anyone is unfamiliar with the Brewer diet, there was a doctor a while ago that came up with this plan where he said, if you, for the prevention or maybe quote unquote treatment of preeclampsia, that is like a total free, no restrictions on calories. Like actually you need to get a minimum of like, you know, what is it? 2,000, 2,500 calories a day or something. It's a lot. You need to eat a lot of food. Basically you need to salt your food to taste. So you're not doing any kind of salt restriction, which I feel like in our non-pregnant states, that's usually like the number one thing people start to do. They're like, I have high blood pressure, I'm going to reduce my sodium intake. But when we are pregnant, that's like one of the worst things that you can do. So do not do that. I mean, unless you're guided by your doctor, but please like look into that. And then there is this huge protein aspect. There is a lot of protein involved. It's like 100 to 120 grams per day. And that it seems really unattainable for a lot of people. But I know personally several clients and friends who were tracking in a high blood pressure sense. They did not have any of the protein, but it was like that midwife who was tracking them very closely and saying, I don't like this. I don't like this. This keeps going up. We're going to do this. And literally watching the numbers just like track back down over the course of several weeks with eating this way. And it unfortunately, it doesn't seem like there's really good solid studies. There's a couple of like, you know, kind of case reports. But it's one of those things that I think should be on the table for those options, right? Or at least attempted or at least offered the education that there's a thing that we can do about this. I don't know. What are your thoughts as a midwife? Do you use it? Have you had success? Tell us.
Yeah, I think that food is really, really, really important. And I think that we underutilize it in our society in general. Women do not understand nutrient density. They don't understand that of course, I'm going out on a limb here by saying this. I could say 90% of the issues that women are having across the board, their entire lifespan, is to some degree a nutrient deficiency issue or nutrient imbalance issue. I think that women are extremely motivated in pregnancy to be the healthiest versions of themselves. And we see radical transformation in pregnancy. Women who are finally willing to learn and implement and utilize nutrition information. And I think that there's so much that can get carried out into the rest of her life from that education and implementation. And so I think we look at what society says is an okay diet, but when we put that against the nutrients that a mother needs in order to build and sustain life, your baby is going to get everything that they need. That is the kicker. It's a really beautiful design in which your baby is totally protected and prioritized. But what happens is all of those nutrient stores will get depleted from the mom. And we see that with these types of disease processes. We see that with osteopenia happening early because her calcium, you know, deposits are being leached from her bones. Women who have need for dental work after or during pregnancies, all of that is pointing towards a lack of nutrient density. So anytime we focus on the diet and work on getting more nutrients into the mom, everything improves. But protein, especially when it comes from good clean sources of protein, quality meat and animal and plant sources, that the way that your body is able to utilize that in pregnancy is incredible because it just feeds every single system. So of course we're making tissue and muscle in our bodies, in our babies, that requires amino acid, protein block, in order to create. And then the systems are taxed because of that. And so we know that if I was going to say there's one thing that pregnant women should prioritize nutrition-wise in pregnancy, I would say protein. Because when we get women eating an adequate amount of protein, which is like 100 grams, that should be the target. The range for, we usually say like 70 to 80 is the bare minimum for protein targets for pregnant women. But that is in order to, that target is set there as the bare minimum in order to avoid malnutrition. So if you're shooting for 70 or 80, and some days you get 65, you're malnourished from a protein perspective. So we want women looking at like 100 grams of protein. And when women eat 100 grams of protein, they sleep better. They have less aches and pains in their body. They have less swelling. They have more blood sugar stability, which turns into better hormone synthesis and mood stability. It's just, there's no end to what protein can do for all of us, but especially in pregnancy. And the effect that it has on the liver is one of the enzymes that is made there, albumin, is responsible for the strength and integrity of our veins and arteries. So what makes them strong and flexible is in part contributed to this enzyme albumin, or maybe it's a protein. I don't know exactly. I can't remember exactly.
It's a protein. Yeah.
It's a protein. And so you require protein in your diet in order to sustain that production. And one of those benefits, one of those side effects, is a stronger, better vascular system, which now we know is associated with so many different pieces of how a disease process might happen, like preeclampsia. The Brewer's diet, I think, is really helpful because it emphasizes enough protein. It emphasizes enough calories. It emphasizes nutrient density. I think it's not completely necessary, and I don't necessarily recommend it as something for women to follow to a T, because it's a ton of dairy, I think, is one of my things. And I think great quality dairy sources are great. I just don't know if we actually need that much of it as the Brewer's diet calls for. And I think for some women, it's really nice to look at a checklist. And that's really the Brewer's diet is advocating for, checking these types of foods off every single day. For some women, that's helpful. And for some women, it's just like psychologically not helpful. So I think there's ways that we can translate some of the principles of it, and we can look at nutrient density, and we can see some overlap with it. And even though the research is good, and I would say if someone's going to eat conventional American standard diet or brewers, I would say absolutely go brewers because you're going to have more nutrients. But I don't think that you need to adhere to that particular diet in the way that it's outlined in order to get the benefits of preventing preeclampsia.
Right. Like you could just follow the principles of the idea of getting this much protein, however you want to do it. Well, maybe just, you know, not primarily protein powders. Hopefully you're eating this in your real food. And I'm glad that you mentioned too about how the protein albumin needs to be made in your body. And I don't know if people totally understand that just keeping up with the hormone rise of estrogen, progesterone in the beginning and throughout the entire pregnancy, hormones are protein conglomerates. So yes, you eat protein, it breaks down into amino acids, it's absorbed, and then now your body rebuilds and makes new proteins with those building blocks. Like that analogy, building blocks has been said trillions of times, but it's true. It's like you have to have these key pieces so that you can then make all of the things. So just that one thing, sustaining the estrogen progesterone rise, which is like 15 times normal or whatever it is, it's huge. It is going to require so much more amino acid bulk base. Like imagine it's a bunch of beads sitting in a bucket for somebody to make like a necklace out of or something. Like we need that. Then now you're creating an entire new body. You're creating an entire new organ of the placenta. You're making way more blood volume for yourself and way more vascular changes with your own motherly body of heart and veins and arteries and everything. Like I don't think people really understand that the cardiovascular remodeling that occurs in the maternal body, it's not just at the side of the uterus and the placenta, it's in throughout the entire body. And that takes a lot, right? So there's just all these things. It's like the amount of nutrition that it takes is so wild. And yet then even to think that lactational energy on a metabolic sense is like even more than in pregnancy too is crazy. And then that's when women are really not eating anything because they have a newborn in their hands. So thank you for that. And I know that this probably deserves way more attention than we're going to give it right now, but can you briefly touch on postpartum preeclampsia? Because this is something that I think absolutely nobody hears about until it's happening to them. And they're like, wait a minute, I don't have the baby inside of me anymore. What is going on? And it's also sometimes missed. It's confusing. Sometimes it's delayed. So can you kind of talk about like, what the heck is going on in postpartum preeclampsia? And what are the signs and symptoms and the kind of like things that people could be watching out for? Because they're usually not even under the care of sometimes they are, sometimes they're not, under the care of a care provider who could catch it. And then how do they treat that?
Yeah. So there, of course, just like prenatal preeclampsia, there's a lot about postpartum preeclampsia that we don't fully understand. But that same idea of organs under stress and the placenta, attachment and vasculation issues, I think to me, it makes the most sense from a physiological perspective, because of everything we've talked about the past hour, that it's something that's in development already and it just becomes more severe with the stressful event of birth and postpartum. So it's like that is the thing that tips it over into the danger zone. And the symptoms are really similar, almost identical to prenatal preeclampsia. It's a persistent headache that won't go away. Visual disturbances, sudden swelling, hypertension is a piece of that puzzle too. And so we think that it's just the way that the way that your body is recovering from whatever the placenta issue was. And then the hormonal changes after birth seem to be a factor in postpartum preeclampsia versus prenatal preeclampsia. And basically it's just catching the hypertension piece of it and getting the hypertension under control in postpartum. And so a lot of times women are, well, I mean, first we need to talk about, I know you said briefly, but first we need to talk about the fact that postpartum preeclampsia can come up in, it can come up in hours or days or weeks after birth. And if you are in a traditional postpartum care setting, you are being discharged from the hospital potentially a day or two after you've given birth. you, all of your vitals might be completely stable and fine. You go home and you are on your own. You're told to look out for these things, but you're told to look out for a lot of things. So something has to become really glaringly obvious and you feel very off, either with just, you know, some of those persistent symptoms perhaps. And then nobody will take your blood pressure again or check on you until you're 6 weeks. Or if you had a C-section, this would actually be a benefit to you. You're going to be checked on at 2 weeks. So then you might have some extra clinical eyes on you. Midwifery care keeps postpartum preeclampsia in mind, just in the frequency in which we provide visits. I mean, in our practice and pretty standard in our community, we see women 6 times in those 6 weeks, and we're checking blood pressure and we're asking, are you experiencing any of these symptoms? We're screening for that. So we can catch it before it's detrimental, but it's a part of some of the really hard maternal mortality rates in our country is missing some of these things postpartum. So having some clinical care postpartum is probably the safest thing for women, and then being treated postpartum, of course, has its own set of complications because now there's a baby involved and most women need to be on blood pressure medication. There's a lot of confusion about how much and how long and it being monitored in a scare tactic way that medical model, you know, tends to provide care, which is like, this is really serious and you could die. Okay, thank you. And so now you need to take this medication. And that's it. Just go home with medication. So no conversation around how to support liver health, how to support your blood pressure, how to manage those pieces while trying to function as a new mom, right? So whole lot of things missing there in that like standard medical conversation.
And what about, so is this a situation where the woman had preeclampsia during her pregnancy and still continues to have it postpartum, or can it come around in the setting of everything was fine, low risk pregnancy, and now we have postpartum preeclampsia?
I don't have statistics available in my mind right now, but typically what we see is preeclampsia as a prenatal event and the detachment of the placenta and the facilitation of the birth actually normalizes things inside of her body and allows preeclampsia to resolve after the birth. And sometimes there's a piece of hypertension that continues in postpartum. And then we're like, is this from preeclampsia or is this from hypertensive disorder that was already kind of at play? I mean, that's something that like is a moving target. And then postpartum preeclampsia, we typically see as its own independent diagnosis. It's not typically related to prenatal preeclampsia. And just my personal theory on that is that if you were pregnant for another week, maybe it would have turned into preeclampsia, or right, that there's some other pieces of that organ damage and inflammation that are already at play. Because the symptoms come up so quickly and severely, it's usually viewed as something that like, oh, there's nothing you can do about it. It just happens to some people. And then it's really challenging and difficult to work through. And we have to, you know, jump on it and act. I just think that it's something that that typically develops over a long period of time. And I think that postpartum preeclampsia is similar. I think it's something that's already been in development. And the risk factors are the same for postpartum preeclampsia as they are for prenatal preeclampsia. So I think it's just being missed clinically. I think there's not enough good clinical postpartum care out there. And so there's not a lot of good clinical screening and it's not being caught.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. This has been amazing. I feel like this is a whole course on preeclampsia for people. So thank you so much, Tiffany, for being with us, for laying this all out. Your clients are extremely lucky to work with you and Kelly. And I'm just I'm such a huge fan of midwives. I feel like I should have been a midwife probably in a different life. Maybe I was. I think it's the coolest thing in the world. And I love specifically what you guys are doing, where you're blending this functional medicine side of things with the individualized holistic approach, which already midwifery birth is, but you're doing so much more on the women's health side of things, not just only relating to pregnancy. And I think that is so cool. You have a supportive membership for your women as well that I'll link in the show notes so people can check that out and all of your offerings. And I just am so grateful for you being here for us and with us today. So thank you very much.
You're so welcome. It's a pleasure to be here and such a great topic. I hope that it really inspired women, even who are not at risk or have experienced preeclampsia, to view the health in their pregnancy just with a little bit more information.
Yeah, me too. Thank you.
Are you pregnant or trying to conceive and looking for reliable, engaging education around how to have a healthy pregnancy and prepare for the future aspects of motherhood to come, like birth, breastfeeding, and postpartum? Well, then look, I've got you. This is exactly the education that you'll receive with my 6-week pregnancy call. You get access to my most comprehensive resource of everything I wish women knew before heading into motherhood. It's simultaneously a pregnancy health course, birth prep series, breastfeeding 101 course, and postpartum planning class all in one. And now it's available not only during our live rounds, where you get tons of one-on-one support from me and a small group of like-minded women, but also in a lessons-only format. The lessons-only version of this course is just that. It's all of the content, but it's without the Q&A calls and without the group chat. This version is available on my website at all times too. So log on to www.milkmedicine.com/lessons-only to check it out, or you can go to the show notes for the link. I hope that you'll enjoy it. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.